Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Daniel Rome, one of our therapists, and James Johnson, our chief of chaplains. And we're privileged again today to have Katie McPherson joining us for a topic entitled Coping and Resiliency, How to Raise Self-Driven Children and Guide Parents Not to Do Everything for Them. Katie, this sounds like a topic that I think many of us might really, really benefit from. Danielle, did you say you had some questions about this?
Oh, yes. Katie, I'm so glad that you're here again. I have a question I've been wanting to ask someone for a long time. I work some with parents who have children that are in their late teen years, early 20s, and who are actually, in some cases, really struggling to learn independence, learning to figure out how to have an apartment, even take care of finances, and parents that are struggling to let go. And I don't have children myself, and so I struggle with how to encourage parents to allow their children to make those mistakes without having the personal experience of coping with that fear. So I'm wondering what thoughts you might have on that, what you might tell parents who are specifically struggling with this.
So Danielle, to answer your question, parents struggling with sort of letting go, allowing their children to fail, allowing them to struggle a little bit. I happened upon this book called The Self-Driven Child, and the authors are named Ned Johnson and Dr. William Sixred, and they're out of Washington, D.C. William is a longtime clinical psychologist. He's probably 78 years old. Ned is a prep tutor, so his main day job, so to speak, is to prepare students to take the ACT and SAT, and most of those students are high achieving elite students who are looking to get into Ivy League. So they have combined forces and written several books. One is coming out soon, but the tenet of the book is we sort of overswung, and this happened in my estimation, in my experience, like post-Columbine, post-9/11, everyone sort of freaked out and was like, okay, schools aren't safe, the world's not safe, I'm going to hunker down, no one's going to hurt my baby. And so for about the last 20-plus years, we've seen parenting become a real verb, where parents are doing everything for their children. They're swooping in, they're engineering play dates, they're choosing the sports they're going to play, what they're going to wear, what they're going to eat, all these things. And so we're exiting these very high-achieving students who are doing great academically, but they literally, like, can't tie their shoe. And so the book's tenets are all about moving your parenting from being a manager of your children to being a consultant and really allowing your child to have choice, because we know that young brains that have choice and feel a sense of competence and feel a sense of autonomy thrive. And so I would say to people who are struggling with this to sort of start, first of all, read the book because it's excellent, tons of strategies, but also recognize, like, this is your kid's life. And so it's our job not to pave the road for them, but prepare them for the road.
Would you say that in addition to consultant, could somebody conceive of the idea of a coach? Because a coach coaches, but then the athlete has to do all the work in order to master the skill or to develop their strength or whatever it might be. Would moving from what was the first one you said they were doing? Manager to coach, would that fit that alignment as well?
Absolutely. And a lot of the, you know, tenets of the book that they outline under the consultant piece, it is coaching. One of the taglines that I love is, I love you too much to fight with you about your homework. You know, if you are working harder than your child, there's a problem. And so really developing that relationship and that trust, but also allowing your child to have some failure too.
And what you just said there, maybe we should help parents with that, because your question was their fear. The parent, yes. Fear. Okay. And I think that probably the parents that are doing this with the motivation of, I want to bless my child. I want to help my child. I want to protect my child. And they're actually driven by fear of what will happen to their child if they don't do something. Yes, right? Rather than love for the yes. for the child. And I think there's an imbalance where they're looking at the potential threat consequence rather than looking at the necessary developmental process that we all have to go through to gain skill. We can't gain skill or mastery if we don't exert ourselves to overcome the problem. I mean, that's just how reality works. And that includes you can't learn to ride a bike if you don't risk falling down and scraping your knee. And you can't do it. Even yet, someday you have to take the training wheels off. And isn't that true?
Absolutely. And I would ask I'd ask Danielle, like, what is showing up in your office as far as, you know, why do you think these parents are so fearful? I have some thoughts, but I'd love to hear from you.
Yes. And so this is actually a follow-up question I had. So because of, you know, kind of the intensity of Honey Lake, we have a lot of people that come in here who are really struggling to function. And so some of the young adults that we have not really been taught by their parents how to cope with life stressors. And so they're overly reliant on substances, maybe to the point of near overdose, right? And so they actually can be quite a danger to themselves. And so the predicament that these parents are in is my child is in their 20s and they've done meth and they've put themselves in all these awful situations. And I never taught them how to be independent. What do I do now, knowing the mistakes that they're capable of?
Okay, I'm going to intervene because your question is very good, but it is really about how do we heal wounds, not how do we help parents help kids grow without getting wounded in the first place. And those are two different populations. If you think about it on a physical level, how do we help heal a broken bone versus how do we help a child, go through ski lessons or whatever else it is without breaking the bone in the first place,
right,
and develop strength. And so the one idea is how do we help parents in their parenting so kids grow with the resilience and then don't find themselves where they have to take drugs just to try to cope with emotions.
Yep.
Okay. Versus those that are now have the wounded kids. How do we help them heal? I think that is actually two divergent groups that are both merit, but maybe we can talk about both. But I think our primary focus here, isn't it, on the helping them develop resiliency to start with, rather than healing brokenness once it's occurred.
I would agree. Those are two different things for sure. I think, you know, with some of the conversations we've had about children and social media and them not developing certain skills, it is also really relevant parents realizing, oh my gosh, I made these mistakes. I didn't equip them. Now, how do I empower them? Because I think parents are still treating, in some cases, their children who are adult children who are in their early mid 20s as if they were still teenagers under their care.
So let's back up and if we have time, let's come back to the healing the broken, because it's very righteous, very good. Maybe we'll have to do a whole nother show on it. But let's maybe lay some foundation, King. Let's lay some foundation on what are the foundational steps, basis that, you know, good practices parents can do raising their kids to help develop that resiliency.
I think first and foremost, you have to get really clear about what success is, because a lot of the drivers behind the parental anxiety and fear are about what they're doing themselves as parents and comparing their child to the rest of the Joneses. And a lot of that is coming from the culture. That started about 25 years ago with the College Board coming down and saying, you have to take the ACT and SAT or else you're not successful. And so then college tuition went up, skyrocketed. And so parents are under an immense amount of pressure to get their kids into college. And they're doing homework for them. Kids are cheating their way through high school. There's an immense amount of academic pressure that I never felt when I went to college. I was a good student, had A's and B's. I wrote a check for $35. I went to Michigan State. Nobody helped me prep for anything. I was doing this all on my own, which I believe is part of the reason why I know how to cope and I am resilient, because I did a lot of that on our own. And so I think we have to look at the cultural drivers behind why these parents are so all over their students about every little thing. And that is coming from this societal norm that unless you go to college, you're not successful and that there's no other pathway. And it's either Yale or McDonald's. And that is truly killing our kids. And when I say killing, I mean by suicide, by overdose. And so we have to get clear about, for each of my children, what does success mean? What does that path look like? What choices do they have? What can I offer them? What can I expose them to? I think that's a super foundational piece before we even talk about parenting strategies, because I've been watching this for 25 years where kids are being driven into the ground by stress and they don't have stress tolerance. They don't know how to cope. They are not resilient because they are maxed out. And I'm talking about 5-year-olds. I'm talking about 9-year-olds. I'm talking about 15-year-olds. It is across the board. We have some chronic and toxic stress going on because of this race for performance.
So I really like what you said there. And I'm going to maybe try to generalize it a little bit and lay some foundation. And what I heard you say is that parents need to not let the values of a godless society become their values on what they internalize and try to apply to their children. But instead, they need to recognize and assess their children as individuals and identify the strengths, gifting, temperaments, personality of the child, and help that child develop down paths where they can thrive with the gifting and skills that they have, rather than try to pigeonhole them into some external defined other definition of what success is. And you can think of along lots of examples along this, but any of us, we all have different skills, abilities, interests, desires, values. And if you get pushed from external pressure to go against what you're really, resonates with your soul, if you will, and you've got to do this or you're bad or you're a failure, you're no good, that is only going to cause stress. And it will, and if you're actually being pushed to do something you're really not talented at in the first place, then it will cause you to come up short of everybody else, which will only reinforce your negative self-image, will lead to this discouragement and hopelessness. And if you had to take on $100,000 of debt to get to this place that you hate to be in the first place anyway for your student loans, then life becomes very demoralized. So I guess foundationally is assess your kids and then help them develop down pathways, and it might be a trade school. There might be some profession of what we consider blue collar of some core, but those are really valuable. And what my dad told me, and I'll tell you, my dad was not college educated, but he told me when I was growing up that he didn't care whether I dug ditches for a living, as long as it was an honest day's work for an honest day's wage. So all he cared about was the integrity of the honesty. And I think that what you described was dishonesty for achieving some external success, cheat on your ACTs, whatever. And it's really shifting away from developing quality people of character to technical performers who are corrupt in character. And there's no peace, there's no joy, there's only guilt, inadequacy, and shame in that. And I think that might be part of the problem. What do you guys think?
Well, one of the things that we started doing back in the 60s and 70s as we began to become more of a global society, and we started importing in Eastern culture that was very different from our Western culture. And the Western culture throughout most of our history has been individual. It's innocence, guilt. It's all about the individual as a person, whereas the Eastern mindset is much more community-based. It's much more about the group and the honor and the shame that each individual brings to the group. And
like the family, for
exactly, instance. Yes, sir. And so one of the things that, thanks to technology, we have become even more integrated and enmeshed with each other. I mean, as a parent of teenagers, I know where they are all the time because I have a program on my phone that tracks their whereabouts. When I was a kid in the 80s and 90s, our parents just threw us outside and said, come home when the sun goes down.
Wait a second, though. I don't want to actually cut off your thought, but what you said there, clarify.
Yeah.
We become more integrated by these things. I'm going to suggest to you we actually become more alienated by these things, not integrated. Because while you're aware of it, you're actually sending the message, I can monitor you. I don't trust you. Your parents trusted you to be where you're supposed to be and be where you're not supposed to be and be back when you're supposed to be. And they weren't able to monitor you. So it was on your integrity, your honesty, your loyalty, your character. Now it's, I can monitor you everywhere because I don't actually trust you, which actually causes alienation in relationship rather than integration. I'm gonna argue that.
Well, and I agree with you that that's the outcome. But, you know, I think that for most people I work with, or including myself, I don't monitor my children's whereabouts because I don't trust them. It's because I care about them. Now, the overall message that does send to them is, I got to know where you are all the time. I think that I agree with you. That's the outcome. I don't think that's always the intention.
Of course. Of course. Yes. Yes.
And so,
but are we becoming integrated then, or are actually we on the relational bonds of love and trust? Is there an undercurrent there that's actually diminishing resilience because we're not actually having, on the other side of it, there's this sense of when you were out there by yourself growing up and your parents didn't know where you were, there is a sense of you had to handle whatever came up. Now, I don't have to handle it. I can call mom. I can call dad. And there's no sense of problem solving or ownership of circumstances or oneself, perhaps. I don't know. I'm throwing this out there for conversation discussion. And Katie, of course, you jump in on any of this as well.
Absolutely. And so, you know, that's where, I guess what I was going with that was now that we have this groupthink mindset, that it's all about the community, it's all about the family, that now the children have become a reflection of the parent. And the parent wants the children to do well, not just because they care about their child, but it's this community. Like, if you do this, you'd bring dishonor to us if you don't get this achievement, if you don't. And a lot of times parents begin to live through their kids, maybe with the best of intentions, but it's because now we think more groupthink and less individualistically. And so I was going to ask Katie, you know, as your experience in the education world, your experience in the family dynamics, where do you see the unhealthy, because obviously this is something that's been around in cultures on the other side of the planet for a long time, but where is the unhealthy balance where the parent begins to live through the child because they may on the surface want good things for them, but it ends up being something they actually put on themselves. If my kid is a failure, I'm a failure kind of mindset.
Yeah, I can only, you know, I have worked in affluent schools. I've worked in Title I schools. I've worked in bilingual schools. I've worked everywhere. And what I can say in my own community, which I would call affluent, it is number one priority for moms to be able to go to a happy hour and talk about how amazing their children are. And I had to, at one point, tell my group of friends, like, we're here to talk with each other about each other. We're here in community as moms. We're supporting each other. And not that we don't want to talk about our kids ever, but this is about us. Because so many of my friends and so many people that I talk to in my audiences, they're literally living through their child and losing their own sense of self because they're in this comparative society, which technology and social media is a huge part of. The things they're posting are to get validation that they're a good parent because their kid just got, you know, the national award for whatever. So I do think it is all tied. And those tools that Tim talked about, you know, the grade portal. So about 15 years ago, we started sending parents to this portal where you could check every single day your child's grades. And parents typically use that as pawn in their parenting game. Like, why didn't you get your homework in? Why did you fail that quiz? What's going on with this? You can't go out because, you know, I'm sure that I didn't always do my homework and I'm a successful individual. Homework shows mastery. It shows skill. It shows organization and time management. These tools like Life 360, you talked about tracking your kids. Some people just have it just to see where their kids are. Some people literally are like, why are you driving 100 miles an hour down the freeway? That is a typical risk that a teenage boy is going to take. And this tracking that we're doing is sending a direct message to our kid. The world's unsafe and you need me to manage your life.
Or I'm not good and I'm in trouble and I need to learn how to be more deceptive and how to lie more to keep people from actually know what I'm doing. I mean, this is also a message. I can tell you there's a lot of things I did growing up as an adolescent that they were not evil things, but they were, certainly were things if my parents known that I was doing, they wouldn't have wanted me to do them. Whether it was speeding would be a good example of that. You know, and I remember on more than one occasion, I was speeding on my way home and I passed a police officer who popped on his lights to get me, but I was around the corner before he actually got behind me. And so I dodged this way and dodged that way and went to somebody else's backyard and parked for 5 minutes. And I mean, I did that kind of stuff and I didn't get a ticket. Okay. You know, my parents probably would not have been happy about that. They didn't know about that. Okay. I mean, these are the kind of things that you're learning how to handle responsibilities and so forth. And so this goes back to the resiliency question. And so we started, I think one point we made is parents assess your children as individuals. And then as you're assessing them as individuals, then work with them to develop their lives primarily first on character qualities. Honesty, loyalty, faithfulness, and second, technical skills. Technical skills are second. Character qualities are first. And then as we go down those trails, the parents then, let's have a conversation about where the parents, and I can give the philosophy, maybe you guys can talk about the specificity, but the philosophy of parenting, healthy parenting, is to set boundaries in which the children have autonomy to act independently. So the parent at a proper age will put a child in a playpen, and the playpen has a boundary, and the child can play with anything the parent put in the playpen from them. They can do whatever they want in the playpen. But the playpen keeps them from getting into mischief. And then it goes from the playpen to the yard, and maybe there's a fence in the yard, and they can play with the toys in the yard and all the stuff in the yard. But the parents set the parameters, and then it's rules of engagement in the community that are enforced. But the parents are constantly, as the child is developing maturity, capacity, intelligence, and so forth, have to be constantly expanding that zone in which, inside that zone, the children get to act autonomously. Okay. And so this is the philosophy. And if we don't do that, then we infantilize them. And I give this example to parents. If you had a child who at learning to walk, toddler, and they stumble and fall and they hit themselves on the floor as they fall and they cry, what would you do as a loving parent? Well, you'd pick them up and you'd comfort them. And then would you say, "Oh, I love you so much. It just breaks my heart to see you in pain like this. I'm never going to set you down again. I'll carry you for the rest of your life." Okay? And of course, no parent would do that physically, but this is what you're describing that parents are doing emotionally. They're carrying the decision and emotional weight for their kids because they can't tolerate the kids' decisions that are not life-ending harmful decisions, but they might be painful decisions that they get scraped and bruised in life by. But that's where we learn, and parents are unwilling, I think, to let their kids because it hurts the parents to see that, "I don't want my child to get hurt." And so they end up carrying the kids. And so I get the philosophy. Where would you help them draw the, you know, those lines? And first off, do you agree with that philosophy?
Oh, 100%. I want to put it on a talking billboard, please. Your face on a talking billboard. I think the word tolerance is absolutely where we can talk more about this. And I'd love to hear from your other guests too. You know, what I find is like these kids are, again, they're rocking history and social science, all the things, 4.5, you know, coming out of high school. But these interactions between peers and interactions between they and their parents. And I don't want to go to USC. I would like to go to the community college and learn welding. Like this top-heavy, top-down management, I'm going to manage your entire life, I believe is the crux of the youth mental health crisis. I know, because I have 4 children, I know that when my kids feel competent and autonomous and socially competent and can interact with other kids, their mental health is better. When they feel a low sense of control, a threat to ego, unpredictability, chaos inside of themselves, their mental health is worse. And so you think about a typical child going to school ages 10 to 18, that world right now is kind of noisy and chaotic, especially if you have access to social media. And so the more sense of control we can build in them, the more predictability as parents we can build in them. I think it staves off what Danielle talked about is the numbing agent, the drugs and the pornography. And, you know, they don't need the escape when they feel like, I got this. I know how to do this. I'm 12 and I'm going to take care of this. I believe that kids are capable of doing that if we give them the time and space to do that. So I'd love to hear, you know, from your other guests as well.
Yeah, something I want to comment on is the avoidance of pain increasing anxiety. So you guys might know it. The verse in Romans, I think, the suffering produces perseverance, which produces character, which produces hope. And so if we're not allowing children to experience suffering and experience pain, and not just experience it, but lean into it and allow it to transform them and grow them to where they can develop the skill to persevere through difficult things and develop a richer character. And then that producing the capacity to have hope in being able to deal with and grow from life circumstances as things inevitably get more complex and more difficult as they get older. And so I think the avoidance of pain from parents and protecting children from experiencing that is also robbing them of that fundamental.
And it's a denial of reality. I mean, part of living is disappointment, things not going the way you expected them to, you know, job changes, life changes, health changes. And if we don't help them learn how to have that resiliency, you know, when I think of resiliency, I think of the difference between an egg and a tennis ball. You know, you can't bounce an egg. It has no resiliency, but you can bounce a tennis ball. You can smack the fool out of that thing with a racket and it bounces right back and is ready for more. And we want, as parents, we want our kids to not be eggs that are so fragile that with the moment something happens, they all fall apart and need all the king's horses and all the king's men to put them back together again, that parents become that when they don't help foster those healthy identity skills. And one of the things that I have wrestled with in my own parenting life is bringing the faith component in on both sides. As a parent, I have to have faith and trust God that God is going to love my children more than I ever could. And so he is going to, if we do things according to his design laws, we're going to be able to help them foster healthy and ultimately happy, satisfying lives. And so like one of the examples that I wrestled with this last year, our oldest daughter turned 15. She got her learner's permit. And she and my wife get in the car and she drives off and I am scared to death that something's going to happen to my baby. And I had to pray, God, this is your baby too. You trusted her to us, but ultimately, you know, you love her too. And you're going to have to do the things I can't do, that I have to trust you in that process to let her be an autonomous person. So faith can play a huge role in creating resiliency in our parenting to say, okay, I can't do everything for them. I can't keep them safe. And one of the dangers of technology and science and all the things that we've gotten is we're more aware of things than we used to ever be. You know, as a kid, I, you know, when talking about my parents just letting me go off and visit my friends unsupervised, well, now, man, we know about the dangers of all the things that lurk around the corner for, you know,
and what you just articulated is the fantasy.
Yes.
It's not reality. When you say we know about all the dangers, I want people to understand that is fantasy. Actually, kids are safer today than they were back when we grew up.
Oh, absolutely.
And those dangers are not all around the corner. That's fantasy, not reality. Not that there are no dangers, but it's not there's dangers lurking around everywhere. That's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But that's the lie we believe. As I guess I'll rephrase it as that way, that we believe. Who knows what's going to happen to my baby if I leave them at the mall?
Right. That's imaginary, projected fantasy of one's own fears and insecurities. And I think it stems on several falsehoods that you just refuted by your own description. But one of the falsehoods is that parents are responsible for how the kids turn out.
Mm-hmm.
And many parents believe that the outcome of their kids' lives is up to the parent. No, no, no. Parents are responsible for their conduct in parenting. They are responsible for their conduct in parenting, their decisions, how they govern themselves. But how the life of the child turns out is not actually up to the parent. The child has their own will, their own decision-making, and there are many other things that influence outcomes other than parents, like peers, other adults in their life, life circumstances that occur. I mean, outcomes are, but parents are responsible for their decision-making. But when you take that ownership, I'm responsible for my kid turns out, then you become very controlling, you become very monitoring, and you're not willing then to let them take the risk and make their own decisions because you want to guard them from turning their life down the wrong trail. But when you understand how reality actually works, at a certain age, once you start doing that, you're actually violating their autonomy, their liberty as God designed it. And the more of that you do, the more rebellion you instill in them, and they will eventually break away to get their freedom, because if they don't, they actually lose their individuality. And so the more controlling and restrictive you get as they grow, the more likely you are to get a rebellious child. That's how reality works.
Or as you said, to destroy their identity, and then they become a shadow person of their parent.
Yeah, yeah. Passive shadow pawn.
And
yeah.
So when we look at this idea, right, so we've got the parent part of it, but we want our kids to develop their faith, to trust God, to learn how reality works, as you wisely said. So you gave this great example earlier of migrating from the playpen to the living room, from the living room to the house, from the house to the yard to the community. What are some of those key moments in life? Like, one of the things that I often think about, this idea of overparenting, when I was a school administrator, and I know, Katie, you can connect to this, that parent that comes in, they've already got the kid's schedule filled out. They've already got the plan for where they're going to go to college, what the, you know, scholarships they're applying for, and the kid has no say in it whatsoever. And so at that point, I recognize something has gone wrong along the way. But where was that moment? And I don't know where that is, and maybe every child's just different, but what are some of those key benchmarks in the parenting process to allow our children at age-appropriate things? What are some of those age-appropriate boundaries to begin to push back from the playpen to the living room? You know, what are those healthy boundary markers as children progress?
I think from what I've seen, I mean, these are just like sort of trivial examples, but like, if your kid doesn't want to play competitive soccer, don't make him play that. Allow him or her the choice to play whatever sport. Just because you played competitive soccer doesn't mean your kid wants to. You know, kids want to wear different types of clothes, especially as they're going through puberty. They're trying on different avatars. They want their own style. I see a lot of parents like, you know, coming down on that, like, what are you wearing? Why would you wear that? That's not appropriate. You know, kids want to express style. Lunch packing, like, I believe that a 6 or 7 year old can pack their own lunch and they can make those choices and pack a healthy lunch. Allow them the choices. Put out the food. Here are the choices. And
no, I got to intervene because what you just said is really important. I don't want anybody to miss what you just said. The parent puts out the food choices and lets the child choose amongst the choices the parent has set. This is the critical thing. The parent doesn't say, go pack your lunch from anything in the house. The parent action, so it was brilliantly done, well done. And so these are the types of things the parents, age appropriate, you might set out for Sunday church or Saturday church, whichever your church goes to. The clothes, 2 or 3 outfits, and you say, which one would you like to wear today? Parent have already approved all of them, but let the child pick the one they want rather than saying you're going to wear that today. And as they grow older, then you set in the teens, here's the, you know, we don't, as a daughter, skirts have to be at least mid-thigh or whatever it is. You set the standard wherever your family is, but then let them pick maybe the style of the thing. But there's no mini skirts or on the beach, no thongs in your adolescent daughter, right? I mean, am I right? You set the standard, but then you might let them pick the colors or styles or whatever it was. But within the parameters, and this is the idea here. One of the things, though, that I want to talk about, and I think for our parents to understand this, I think this is the dynamic that leads to this lack of resilience and helping the children with your question of growing is helping them and it's usually mid-adolescence, late adolescence, shifting away from making decisions primarily based on maintaining parental approval and positive regard. My parents are not upset with me. Most children's decisions are in the context of my parents will be upset if I don't. There's a consequence. I want my parents' happiness with me. Toward eventually the parents saying regarding the education, what are you going to go to school and college, whatever. Hey, as long as you're doing an honest day's wage for an honest day's work, you know, I'll be happy with you. My love for you, my acceptance of you will not change if you become a welder or you become a college professor. I'll love you just as much as long as you're happy and thriving. However, have you thought through the consequence of what kind of life you might have, what kind of work options, what kind of flexibility, the consequences on your life of choosing this path on that path, shifting it away. I'm doing this because mom wants me to, towards there's real world objective outcome differences if I do want or the other. That is an important shift in decision-making that has to happen. You typically lead adolescents away from, as they, particularly when they're planning their college career and other things, and they can free themselves up. I can do anything and I don't fear my parents' rejection, but I can't do anything and get the same outcomes in my life.
I've seen so many kids, and specifically boys, but I'm sure there's some girls in there. But when I think about this, like, you know, the one sport athlete that's played baseball his whole life, you know, the high school team only has 16 spots. There, our schools here have 3,000 or 4,000 students. And so, you know, this focus on like one sport or this one thing that I'm allowed to do, or I'm only allowed to apply to this college, like, we have to open up those pathways. There's so many neat programs, community college programs that are now, you know, giving bachelor's. You don't have to go to a university. You can go into the trades. The trades are dying for kids. Like, they need more people.
And you can make good living in those trades.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but that goes back to this culture of what is success. And currently across America, what I have seen is my kid is only successful if he goes to a good college. And that is, we need to change that mindset.
So things that help build resilience. I just want to get some very basic ones. We're not spending a lot of time on it, but I want parents to understand resilience comes from physiologically good health. If you're not healthy, because resilience is part of having a certain level of energy to be able to confront the obstacles of life and to be able to then wrestle through them and overcome. And if you are fatigued, worn out, tired, unhealthy, you don't have the even energy to engage the problem. And so physiologic good health, and parents do that by actually overseeing the dietary choices. In other words, healthy foods rather than all the junk food, fast food, sodas and all this kind of stuff. A really healthy food helps healthy brains. And that actually, multiple studies show this. You get resilience if you, and then sleep. You know, kids need more sleep than adults. And depending on the age, and this is because it's during sleep that the brain is remodeling, restructuring, and removing all the waste products of metabolism that happen. And the kids' brains are going through way more remodeling and have way more waste products to clear. So they need more hours of sleep. And it's age dependent. The infants need like 18 hours of sleep a day or something because there's so much going on. And then our younger children will need 8 to 10 hours of sleep a night. I mean, excuse me, 10 to 12 hours of sleep a night. And then your adolescents still need 11 hours of sleep, 9 hours of sleep. It's only when you become a brain is fully developed at age 25, you need 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And so a lot of young people are not getting adequate sleep, which means they awaken. And this is part school schedules too. School schedules are hurting kids because they're not getting adequate sleep and their brains are fatigued and prefrontal cortex is fatigued. That's where you problem solve and you send a calming signal down. So sleep is important. Exercise programs build resilience, and it doesn't have to be a competitive exercise. It can be fun exercise, but getting out and playing and off the device is actually important for brain development. And that actually builds a resilience. And then what you said, the spirituality piece. Mm-hmm. I don't know if are you seeing much in the way of young people today? Where would you say, and what you're seeing in the school systems, on the spiritual level of the young people today in our society?
It's not good. You know, in Arizona, we have a large Latter-day Saints population, and so we have seminaries on every campus. So those students are attending daily. But as far as attendance, when we look at our young males specifically attending church males across the lifespan, we're not seeing as many students participate.
Well, and one of the things that we've done, and I know we've talked about the in a different episode, the evidence for God, but I grew up in a time when if the idea in the classroom, whether it was high school, college, whatever, is if you believe in God, you're stupid. Because look at all the evidence, and it was nobody was able to legally teach intelligent design creationism in school because of the Scopes trials in the 1920s. So for over 100 years, we've been telling kids in school, you're an accident of the universe. You're here purely by chance. Your life ultimately has no meaning. And there is no true basis for right and wrong other than feelings and culture. And so we're seeing that played out in the larger realm when we kids are not able to have that sense of identity that comes from, oh, God made me on purpose, with a purpose, for a purpose, and they don't have that internal, you know, validation, so they look for it externally.
And that goes to resilience. If you actually believe about yourself that your life has no meaning or purpose, that leads to nihilism, mm-hmm. discouragement, hopelessness. What's it matter? You just are floating through the vicissitudes and circumstances of life. You have no, you know, it's just, you're a blob. So that mindset can undermine resilience, where those who actually have an identity, a sense of meaning, a purpose for their life, that they're on a mission that they value themselves, that will give them a certain strength to overcome obstacles. What do you think about that?
I think it's spot on, and I would speak to the education side of that. You know, this generation has all of these things, right? The video games, the social media, the current relevant sort of content. And so boys specifically, when we look at 78% of them are getting D's and F's, our substance abuse referrals are going to our boys. School is not built for boys. It's 2025, and it is absolutely not built for boys. And so when they look at a teacher like, why should I do this work? And they don't find the purpose, and maybe they're not the greatest student and they're not college bound. There's a lot going on there. And I would imagine that Danielle's seeing some of those boys and some of those families. And it's not that girls don't struggle, but boys, when they go to school, specifically want to know why. Why do I have to do this? What's the purpose? What is this going to get me? And so we have to be more relevant in our schools and homes as to what is your purpose? What is your divine purpose? And I think schools need to catch up, because these kids are like, I can go watch Netflix and learn something from this very solid documentary that's better than what I'm learning in the classroom. They're trying to find a sense of purpose during a very pivotal moment in their life. And we're not there content-wise in the schools themselves.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard various people talk about a shift in our, a desire to shift away from our current educational structure to basically moving back to an older system where all children get about 6 grades of education for reading, writing, and arithmetic. And then about the 7th or 8th grade, somewhere around there, you begin tracking the academic pathways versus trade school pathways. And you let the boys start going down trade schools, carpentry, plumbing, welding, the old, what was it in the culture where you apprenticeships, where you take an apprenticeship with somebody and you might work for 5 or 6 years as an apprentice for somebody, kind of like a what we do in residencies now after medical school. You go into residency under the you know, attending physician, and you have that. But going into apprenticeships in these trades and skills because a lot of men particularly are not interested and or even maybe neurologically wired for sitting in a chair and just doing academic work.
Yeah, boys are hands-on experiential learners. And I know I shared last time I was with you about Dr. Gurian's work, but, you know, these 90-minute blocks where there's no movement, you know, we're seeing kids get aggressive in the classroom. They're fidgety, they're, you know, turning around, they're blurting out, and teachers are saying things to them like, are you ADHD? And so parents go and get a prescription for Ritalin. We have prescribed 20 times more ADHD meds for boys in the last 10 years than we ever have. And I believe those boys, a lot of them are just boys. They need movement. All kids need movement.
Well, I'm going to agree with you on that, and I'm going to say that this is also a factor of what else we've been talking about. I agree with you that boys do need more movement. I've read his book as well, and I think there's neurologically that's true that the sitting in a chair for hours of time will naturally result in the boys wanting to get up, move, throw things, and this is what boys do. On the other hand, to add to that, we have reduced playtime. They're not out play. They're on digital devices. That's going to add to that. And on top of that, theatrical entertainment neurobiologically changes developing brains so that if they're watching programming rather than engaging, they don't develop prefrontal cortex. And multiple studies show that increases in attention, distractibility, impulsivity, because prefrontal cortex is where you attend, self-restraint. And so kids, the more theatrical programming they watch, the more ADHD symptomology and impulse control problems they have than kids who don't. So I think the boys are more prone. And I also think societally we've done things to magnify that difference. And then it's just a pharmaceutical to medicate rather than neural to biologically develop in healthy ways.
Yeah. Lastly, on the resiliency front, I get a lot of calls from parents saying, how do I make my child more resilient? And in my opinion, resilience is built over time through challenges, failures, adversity, as he said.
Yeah, and this is the philosophy. I'm sure you read the book, The Coddling of the American Mind, okay? And the historic philosophy that you quoted, Danielle, which is the wisdom of all the sages of all the cultures, is that it's through adversity and trials that we overcome, that we gain mastery and strength. And the street slang for that is, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. Okay, that's the street slang for that principle. But that has been turned upside down in our society. And anything that is uncomfortable or emotionally distressing to you is harmful and should be avoided. And this is what's happened in our society today, where people avoid the challenges. And if somebody, says something that hurts your feelings, then they're an aggressor. And it's not you that need to actually overcome the feelings and the challenges of whatever that circumstance is. It's that your society needs to change so you never actually face any challenges anymore. And that is a very corrosive idea that has taken hold. And I think what this last generation, for sure, may be another one. And seems like maybe we're going to swing back the other way, because it's completely failed, because it's contrary to how reality works. So resiliency, we don't want to abuse anybody. Abuse doesn't bring resiliency, but challenges of life that are hard and adversities do.
Yep.
And one of the things that we've lost as a culture is this ability to fail forward. You know, there's no safe space to try something, fail, and say, that's okay, do it again. You know, when kids are little and learning to walk, we don't yell at them when they stumble and fall after they take a step. We encourage them. We say, get up and do it again. You know, when I was a kid learning to ride my bike and I fell, my dad didn't come over and yell at me. He said, hey, you made it 20 feet. Let's get up and let's do it again. It was a safe space to fail forward, to learn from the mistake and move forward. And you talked about this thing where we used to have in schools, we had structured or unstructured playtime. You would have physical education where the teacher would teach you a skill. They teach you a game. They teach you an activity. And then later in the day, you would get recess, this unstructured open playtime, so the kids could practice that skill, just the kids. Mm-hmm. And if they failed, they learned. And they said, okay, so a grade's not riding on this. My social acceptance is not riding on it. I'm in a safe place to fail and grow. And now, because, you know, we've taken that out of schools in the name of getting academics up, that now, because everything is documented, we have people that, you know, these generations, these younger kids, every moment of their life has been documented in real time thanks to technology. And in some ways, that's wonderful for, you know, mementos and photography and videos and that kind of thing. But there's no open space where if I fail and I embarrass myself in front of everybody, that video may show up on Snapchat. That every friend in the school may see me try to shoot that basket and miss it and laugh at me. And so there's no longer that safe space to fail forward. And so we'd rather not. And then there's no resiliency build.
That's a good point. Well, thank you all for this conversation. I'm going to kind of sum up what maybe high points of what we talked about for parents trying to help their kids with resiliency. Parents move away from managing to coaching. Parents identify and understand their children as individuals, their strengths, their talents, their aspirations, their temperaments, and help as a coach them have the experiences of life with ever increasing boundaries, if you will, where they can have autonomy to make decisions and experience and reap the consequences of those and learn from those experiences, and provide the healthy environment, healthy nutrition, sleep structure, restriction to access that they're not ready to handle yet, like the digital world at an appropriate age, exercise that's appropriate, bringing spirituality to the home as parents, leading in that home to lead them in their true identity. And then at the appropriate to decouple the approval from the decision. In other words, your decision has real world consequences in your life. And I'm going to love you either way, as long as it's a decision. I'll love you either way. But my approval is not based on what choice you make, unless I will disapprove of actually unethical, immoral decisions. I'm not going to approve of those. But if you do a different career, I'm approving of it. It's honest. If you've got good character, I'm going to approve. This type of a perspective helped that child develop that ability and realize their connection and bond with their parents is not dependent on doing what the parent wants. It's dependent on being that healthy person and becoming that healthy person. So thank you all for this conversation today. And thank you all for joining us for this today. Hope you'll join us again next time. If you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net. Questions@designformore.net. And we'll see you again next time. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.